each night instead of drinking, said Tonnegan. You can relax and talk through your anxieties at the meetings. The triggers and payoffs stay the same. It's just the behavior that changes. One particularly dramatic demonstration of how alcoholics' cues and rewards can be transferred to new routines occurred in 2007, when Mueller, the German neurologist, and his colleagues at the University of Magdeburg implanted small electrical devices inside the brains of five alcoholics who had repeatedly tried to give up booze. The alcoholics in the study had each spent at least 6 months in rehab without success. One of them had been through detox more than 60 times. The devices implanted in the men's heads were positioned inside their basal ganglia, the same part of the brain where the MIT researchers found the habit loop. And they emitted an electrical charge that interrupted the neurological reward that triggers habitual cravings. After the men recovered from the operations, they were exposed to cues that had once triggered alcoholic urges, such as photos of beer or trips to a bar. Normally, it would have been impossible for them to resist a drink. But the devices inside their brains overrode each man's neurological cravings. They didn't touch a drop. One of them told me the craving disappeared as soon as we turned the electricity on, Mueller said. Then we turned it off, and the craving came back immediately. Eradicating the alcoholic's neurological cravings, however, wasn't enough to stop their drinking habits. Four of them relapsed soon after the surgery, usually after a stressful event. They picked up a bottle because that's how they automatically dealt with anxiety. However, once they learned alternate routines for dealing with stress, the drinking stopped for good. One patient, for instance, attended AA meetings. Others went to therapy. And once they incorporated those new routines for coping with stress and anxiety into their lives, the successes were dramatic. The man who had gone to detox 60 times never had another drink. Two other patients had started drinking at 12, were alcoholics by 18, drank every day, and now have been sober for 4 years. Notice how closely this study hews to the golden rule of habit change. Even when alcoholics' brains were changed through surgery, it wasn't enough. The old cues and cravings for rewards were still there, waiting to pounce. The alcoholics only permanently changed once they learned new routines that drew on the old triggers and provided a familiar relief. Some brains are so addicted to alcohol that only surgery can stop it, said Mueller. But those people also need new ways for dealing with life. AA provides a similar, though less invasive, system for inserting new routines into old habit loops. As scientists have begun understanding how AA works, they've started applying the program's methods to other habits, such as two-year-olds' tantrums, sex addictions, and even minor behavioral tics. As AA's methods have spread, they've been refined into therapies that can be used to disrupt almost any pattern. In the summer of 2006, a 24-year-old graduate student named Mandy walked into the counseling center at Mississippi State University. For most of her life, Mandy had bitten her nails, gnawing them until they bled. Lots of people bite their nails. For chronic nail biters, however, it's a problem of a different scale. Mandy would often bite until her nails pulled away from the skin underneath. Her fingertips were covered with tiny scabs. The end of her fingers had become blunted without nails to protect them, and sometimes they tingled or itched, a sign of nerve injury. The biting habit had damaged her social life. She was so embarrassed around her friends that she kept her hands in her pockets, and on dates would become preoccupied with balling her fingers into fists. She had tried to stop by painting her nails with foul-tasting polishes or promising herself, starting right now, that she would muster the willpower to quit. But as soon as she began doing homework or watching television, her fingers ended up in her mouth. The counseling center referred Mandy to a doctoral psychology student who was studying a treatment known as habit reversal training. The psychologist was well acquainted with the golden rule of habit change. He knew that changing Mandy's nail-biting habit required inserting a new routine into her life. What do you feel right before you bring your hand up to your mouth to bite your nails? He asked her.
There's a little bit of tension in my fingers, Mandy said. It hurts a little bit here, at the edge of the nail. Sometimes I'll run my thumb along looking for hangnails, and when I feel something catch, I'll bring it up to my mouth. Then I'll go finger by finger, biting all the rough edges. Once I start, it feels like I have to do all of them.
Asking patients to describe what triggers their habitual behavior is called awareness training. And like AA's insistence on forcing alcoholics to recognize their cues, it's the first step in habit reversal training. The tension that Mandy felt in her nails cued her nail-biting habit. Most people's habits have occurred for so long, they don't pay attention to what causes it anymore, said Brad Dufresne, who treated Mandy. I've had stutterers come in, and I'll ask them which words or situations trigger their stuttering, and they won't know because they stopped noticing so long ago. Next, the therapist asked Mandy to describe why she bit her nails. At first, she had trouble coming up with reasons. As they talked, though, it became clear that she bit when she was bored. The therapist put her in some typical situations, such as watching television and doing homework, and she started nibbling. When she had worked through all of the nails, she felt a brief sense of completeness, she said. That was the habit's reward, a physical stimulation she had come to crave. At the end of their first session, the therapist sent Mandy home with an assignment. Carry around an index card, and each time you feel the cue, a tension in your fingertips, make a check mark on the card. She came back a week later with 28 checks. She was, by that point, acutely aware of the sensations that preceded her habit. She knew how many times it occurred during class or while watching television. Then the therapist taught Mandy what is known as a competing response. Whenever she felt that tension in her fingertips, he told her, she should immediately put her hands in her pockets or under her legs, or grip a pencil or something else that made it impossible to put her fingers in her mouth. Then Mandy was to search for something that would provide a quick physical stimulation, such as rubbing her arm or rapping her knuckles on a desk. Anything that would produce a physical response. The cues and rewards stayed the same, only the routine changed. They practiced in the therapist's office for about 30 minutes, and Mandy was sent home with a new assignment. Continue with the index card, but make a check when you feel the tension in your fingertips and a hash mark when you successfully override the habit. A week later, Mandy had bitten her nails only 3 times and had used the competing response 7 times. She rewarded herself with a manicure, but kept using the note cards. After a month, the nail-biting habit was gone. The competing routines had become automatic. One habit had replaced another. It seems ridiculously simple. But once you're aware of how your habit works, once you recognize the cues and rewards, you're halfway to changing it, Nathan Azrin, one of the developers of habit reversal training, told me. It seems like it should be more complex. The truth is, the brain can be reprogrammed. You just have to be deliberate about it. It is important to note that though the process of habit change is easily described, it does not necessarily follow that it is easily accomplished. It is facile to imply that smoking, alcoholism, overeating, or other ingrained patterns can be upended without real effort. Genuine change requires work and self-understanding of the cravings driving behaviors. Changing any habit requires determination. No one will quit smoking cigarettes simply because they sketch a habit loop. However, by understanding habits' mechanisms, we gain insights that make new behaviors easier to grasp. Anyone struggling with addiction or destructive behaviors can benefit from help from many quarters, including trained therapists, physicians, social workers, and clergy. Even professionals in those fields, though, agree that most alcoholics, smokers, and other people struggling with problematic behaviors quit on their own, away from formal treatment settings. Much of the time, those changes are accomplished because people examine the cues, cravings, and rewards that drive their behaviors and then find ways to replace their self-destructive routines with healthier alternatives, even if they aren't fully aware of what they are doing at the time. Understanding the cues and cravings driving your habits won't make them suddenly disappear, but it will give you a way to plan how to change the pattern. Today, habit reversal therapy is used to treat verbal and physical tics, depression, smoking, gambling problems, anxiety, bedwetting, procrastination, obsessive-compulsive disorders, and other behavioral problems. And its techniques lay bare one of the fundamental principles of habits. Often, we don't really understand the cravings driving our behaviors until we look for them. Mandy never realized that a craving for physical stimulation was causing her nail biting. But once she dissected the habit, it became easy to find a new routine that provided the same reward. Say you want to stop snacking at work. Is the reward you're seeking to satisfy your hunger? Or is it to interrupt boredom? If you snack for a brief release, you can easily find another routine, such as taking a quick walk or giving yourself 3 minutes on the internet. That provides the same interruption without adding to your waistline. If you want to stop smoking, ask yourself, do you do it because you love nicotine or because it provides a burst of stimulation, a structure to your day, a way to socialize? If you smoke because you need stimulation, studies indicate that some caffeine in the afternoon can increase the odds you'll quit. More than 3 dozen studies of former smokers have found that identifying the cues and rewards they associate with cigarettes and then choosing new routines that provide similar payoffs, a piece of Nicorette, a quick series of push-ups, or simply taking a few minutes to stretch and relax, makes it more likely they will quit. If you identify the cues and rewards, you can change the routine. At least, most of the time. For some habits, however, there's one other ingredient that's necessary. Belief. 3. Here are the 6 reasons everyone thinks we can't win, Dungy told his Buccaneers after becoming head coach in 1996. It was months before the season started, and everyone was sitting in the locker room. Dungy started listing the theories they had all read in the newspapers or heard on the radio. The team's management was messed up. Their new coach was untested. The players were spoiled. The city didn't care. Key players were injured. They didn't have the talent they needed. Those are the supposed reasons, Dungy said. Now here is a fact. Nobody is going to outwork us. Dungy's strategy, he explained, was to shift the team's behaviors until their performances were automatic. He didn't believe the Buccaneers needed the thickest playbook. He didn't think they had to memorize hundreds of formations. They just had to learn a few key moves and get them right every time. However, perfection is hard to achieve in football. Every play in football, every play, someone messes up, said Herm Edwards, one of Dungy's assistant coaches in Tampa Bay. Most of the time, it's not physical. It's mental. Players mess up when they start thinking too much or second-guessing their plays. What Dungy wanted was to take all that decision-making out of their game. And to do that, he needed them to recognize their existing habits and accept new routines. He started by watching how his team already played. "Let's work on the under defense," Dungy shouted at a morning practice one day. "Number 55, what's your read?" "I'm watching the running back and guard," said Derek Brooks, an outside linebacker. "What precisely are you looking at? Where are your eyes?" "I'm looking at the movement of the guard," said Brooks. "I'm watching the QB's legs and hips after he gets the ball. And I'm looking for gaps in the line to see if they're going to pass and if the QB is going to throw to my side or away." In football, these visual cues are known as keys, and they're critical to every play. Dungy's innovation was to use these keys as cues for reworked habits. He knew that sometimes Brooks hesitated a moment too long at the start of a play. There were so many things for him to think about. Is the guard stepping out of formation? Does the running back's foot indicate he's preparing for a running or a passing play? That sometimes he slowed down. Dungy's goal was to free Brooks' mind from all that analysis. Like Alcoholics Anonymous, he used the same cues that Brooks was already accustomed to, but gave him different routines that eventually occurred automatically. "I want you to use those same keys," Dungy told Brooks. "But at first, focus only on the running back. That's it. Do it without thinking. Once you're in position, then start looking for the QB." This was a relatively modest shift. Brooks' eyes went to the same cues, but rather than looking multiple places at once, Dungy put them in a sequence and told him ahead of time the choice to make when he saw each key. The brilliance of this system was that it removed the need for decision-making. It allowed Brooks to move faster because everything was a reaction, and eventually a habit, rather than a choice. Dungy gave every player similar instructions and practiced the formations over and over. It took almost a year for Dungy's habits to take hold. The team lost early, easy games. Sports columnist asked why the Bucks were wasting so much time on psychological quackery. But slowly, they began to improve. Eventually, the patterns became so familiar to players that they unfolded automatically when the team took the field. In Dungy's second season as coach, the Bucks won their first 5 games and went to the playoffs for the first time in 15 years. In 1999, they won the division championship. Dungy's coaching style started drawing national attention. The sports media fell in love with his soft-spoken demeanor, religious piety, and the importance he placed on balancing work and family. Newspaper stories described how he brought his sons, Eric and Jamie, to the stadium so they could hang out during practice. They did their homework in his office and picked up towels in the locker room. It seemed like, finally, success had arrived. In 2000, the Bucks made it to the playoffs again, and then again in 2001. Fans now filled the stadium every week. Sportscasters talked about the team as Super Bowl contenders. It was all becoming real. But even as the Bucks became a powerhouse, a troubling problem emerged. They often played tight, disciplined games. However, during crucial, high-stress moments, everything would fall apart. In 1999, after racking up 6 wins in a row at the end of the season, the Bucks blew the conference championship against the St. Louis Rams. In 2000, they were 1 game away from the Super Bowl when they disintegrated against the Philadelphia Eagles, losing 21-3. The next year, the same thing happened again, and the Bucks lost to the Eagles 31-9, blowing their chance of advancing. We would practice, and everything would come together, and then we'd get to a big game, and it was like the training disappeared, Dungy told me. Afterward, my players would say, "Well, it was a critical play, and I went back to what I knew," or, "I felt like I had to step it up." What they were really saying was they trusted our system most of the time, but when everything was on the line, that belief broke down. At the conclusion of the 2001 season, after the Bucks had missed the Super Bowl for the second straight year, the team's general manager asked Dungy to come to his house. He parked near a huge oak tree, walked inside, and 30 seconds later was fired. The Bucks would go on to win the Super Bowl the next year using Dungy's formations and players, and by relying on the habits he had shaped. He would watch on television as the coach who replaced him lifted up the Lombardi Trophy. But by then, he would already be far away. 4. About 60 people, soccer moms and lawyers on lunch breaks, old guys with fading tattoos, and hipsters in skinny jeans, are sitting in a church and listening to a man with a slight paunch and a tie that complements his pale blue eyes. He looks like a successful politician, with the warm charisma of assured re-election. "My name is John," he says, "and I'm an alcoholic." "Hi, John," everyone replies. "The first time I decided to get help was when my son broke his arm," John says. He's standing behind a podium. "I was having an affair with a woman at work, and she told me that she wanted to end it. So I went to a bar and had 2 vodkas and went back to my desk, and at lunch I went to Chili's with a friend and we each had a few beers. And then, at about 2 o'clock, me and another friend left and found a place with a 2-for-1 happy hour. It was my day to pick up the kids. My wife didn't know about the affair yet. So I drove to their school and got them. And I was driving home on a street I must have driven 1,000 times, and I slammed into a stop sign at the end of the block. Up on the sidewalk, and bam, right into the sign. Sam, that's my boy, hadn't put on his seatbelt, so he flew against the windshield and broke his arm. There was blood on the dash where he hit his nose, and the windshield was cracked. And I was so scared. That's when I decided I needed help. So I checked into a clinic and then came out. And everything was pretty good for a while. For about 13 months, everything was great. I felt like I was in control, and I went to meetings every couple of days. But eventually I started thinking, I'm not such a loser that I need to hang out with a bunch of drunks. So, I stopped going. Then my mom got cancer, and she called me at work almost 2 years after I got sober. She was driving home from the doctor's office, and she said, "He told me we can treat it, but it's pretty advanced." The first thing I did after I hung up is find a bar. And I was pretty much drunk for the next 2 years, until my wife moved out, and I was supposed to pick up my kids again. I was in a really bad place by then. A friend was teaching me to use coke, and every afternoon I would do a line inside my office, and 5 minutes later I would get that little drip into the back of my throat and do another line. Anyways, it was my turn to get the kids. I was on the way to their school, and I felt totally fine, like I was on top of everything. And I pulled into an intersection when the light was red, and this huge truck slammed into my car and actually flipped the car on its side. I didn't have a scratch on me. I got out and started trying to push my car over because I figured if I can make it home and leave before the cops arrive, I'll be fine. Of course, that didn't work out. And when they arrested me for DUI, they showed me how the passenger side of the car was completely crushed in. That's where Sammy usually sat. If he had been there, he would have been killed. So I started going to meetings again, and my sponsor told me that it didn't matter if I felt in control. Without a higher power in my life, without admitting my powerlessness, none of it was going to work. I thought that was bull. I'm an atheist. But I knew that if something didn't change, I was going to kill my kids. So, I started working at that. Working at believing in something bigger than me. And it's working. I don't know if it's God or something else. But there is a power that has helped me stay sober for 7 years now. And I'm in awe of it. I don't wake up sober every morning. I mean, I haven't had a drink in 7 years, but some mornings I wake up feeling like I'm going to fall down that day. Those days, I look for the higher power, and I call my sponsor. And most of the time, we don't talk about drinking. We talk about life and marriage and my job. And by the time I'm ready for a shower, my head is on straight. The first cracks in the theory that Alcoholics Anonymous succeeded solely by reprogramming participants' habits started appearing a little over a decade ago and were caused by stories from alcoholics like John. Researchers began finding that habit replacement worked pretty well for many people until the stresses of life, such as finding out your mom has cancer or your marriage is coming apart, got too high. At which point, alcoholics often fell off the wagon. Academics asked why, if habit replacement is so effective, it seemed to fail at such critical moments. And as they dug into alcoholic stories to answer that question, they learned that replacement habits only become durable new behaviors when they are accompanied by something else. One group of researchers at the Alcohol Research Group in California, for instance, noticed a pattern in interviews. Over and over again, alcoholics said the same thing. Identifying cues and choosing new routines is important, but without another ingredient, the new habits never fully took hold. The secret, the alcoholics said, was God. Researchers hated that explanation. God and spirituality are not testable hypotheses. Churches are filled with drunks who continue drinking despite a pious faith. In conversations with addicts, though, spirituality kept coming up again and again. So in 2005, a group of scientists, this time affiliated with UC Berkeley, Brown University, and the National Institutes of Health, began asking alcoholics about all kinds of religious and spiritual topics. Then they looked at the data to see if there was any correlation between religious belief and how long people stayed sober.
a pattern emerged. Alcoholics who practiced the techniques of habit replacement, the data indicated, could often stay sober until there was a stressful event in their lives, at which point a certain number started drinking again, no matter how many new routines they had embraced. However, those alcoholics who believed, like John in Brooklyn, that some higher power had entered their lives were more likely to make it through the stressful periods with their sobriety intact. It wasn't God that mattered, the researchers figured out. It was belief itself that made a difference. Once people learned how to believe in something, that skill started spilling over to other parts of their lives, until they started believing they could change. Belief was the ingredient that made a reworked habit loop into a permanent behavior. I wouldn't have said this a year ago. That's how fast our understanding is changing, said Tonnegan, the University of New Mexico researcher. But belief seems critical. You don't have to believe in God, but you do need the capacity to believe that things will get better. Even if you give people better habits, it doesn't repair why they started drinking in the first place. Eventually, they'll have a bad day, and no new routine is going to make everything seem okay. What can make a difference is believing that they can cope with that stress without alcohol. By putting alcoholics in meetings where belief is a given, where in fact belief is an integral part of the 12 steps, AA trains people in how to believe in something until they believe in the program and themselves. It lets people practice believing that things will eventually get better, until things actually do. At some point, people in AA look around the room and think, if it worked for that guy, I guess it can work for me, said Leanne Kaskoudis, a senior scientist at the Alcohol Research Group. There's something really powerful about groups and shared experiences. People might be skeptical about their ability to change if they're by themselves, but a group will convince them to suspend disbelief. A community creates belief. As John was leaving the AA meeting, I asked him why the program worked now after it had failed him before. When I started coming to meetings after the truck accident, someone asked for volunteers to help put away the chairs, he told me. I raised my hand. It wasn't a big thing. It took like 5 minutes. But it felt good to do something that wasn't all about me. I think that started me on a different path. I wasn't ready to give in to the group the first time. But when I came back, I was ready to start believing in something. 5. Within a week of Dungy's firing by the Bucks, the owner of the Indianapolis Colts left an impassioned 15-minute message on his answering machine. The Colts, despite having one of the NFL's best quarterbacks, Peyton Manning, had just finished a dreadful season. The owner needed help. He was tired of losing, he said. Dungy moved to Indianapolis and became head coach. He immediately started implementing the same basic game plan, remaking the Colts' routines and teaching players to use old cues to build reworked habits. In his first season, the Colts went 10-6 and qualified for the playoffs. The next season, they went 12-4 and came within one game of the Super Bowl. Dungy's celebrity grew. Newspaper and television profiles appeared around the country. Fans flew in so they could visit the church Dungy attended. His sons became fixtures in the Colts' locker room and on the sidelines. In 2005, Jamie, his eldest boy, graduated from high school and went to college in Florida.
Even as Dungy's successes mounted, however, the same troubling patterns emerged. The Colts would play a season of disciplined winning football, and then under playoff pressure, choke. Belief is the biggest part of success in professional football, Dungy told me. The team wanted to believe, but when things got really tense, they went back to their comfort zones and old habits. The Colts finished the 2005 regular season with 14 wins and 2 losses, the best record in its history. Then, tragedy struck. 3 days before Christmas, Tony Dungy's phone rang in the middle of the night. His wife answered and handed him the receiver, thinking it was one of his players. There was a nurse on the line. Dungy's son, Jamie, had been brought into the hospital earlier in the evening, she said, with compression injuries on his throat. His girlfriend had found him hanging in his apartment, a belt around his neck. Paramedics had rushed him to the hospital, but efforts at revival were unsuccessful. He was gone. A chaplain flew to spend Christmas with the family. Life will never be the same again, the chaplain told them. But you won't always feel like you do right now. A few days after the funeral, Dungy returned to the sidelines. He needed something to distract himself, and his wife and team encouraged him to go back to work. I was overwhelmed by their love and support, he later wrote. As a group, we had always leaned on each other in difficult times. I needed them now more than ever. The team lost their first playoff game, concluding their season. But in the aftermath of watching Dungy during this tragedy, something changed, one of his players from that period told me. We had seen Coach through this terrible thing, and all of us wanted to help him somehow. It is simplistic, even cavalier, to suggest that a young man's death can have an impact on football games. Dungy has always said that nothing is more important to him than his family. But in the wake of Jamie's passing, as the Colts started preparing for the next season, something shifted, his players say. The team gave in to Dungy's vision of how football should be played in a way they hadn't before. They started to believe. I had spent a lot of previous seasons worrying about my contract and salary, said one player who, like others, spoke about that period on the condition of anonymity. When Coach came back after the funeral, I wanted to give him everything I could to take away his hurt. I kind of gave myself to the team. Some men like hugging each other, another player told me. I don't. I haven't hugged my sons in a decade. But after Coach came back, I walked over and I hugged him as long as I could, because I wanted him to know that I was there for him. After the death of Dungy's son, the team started playing differently. A conviction emerged among players about the strength of Dungy's strategy. In practices and scrimmages leading up to the start of the 2006 season, the Colts played tight, precise football. Most football teams aren't really teams. They're just guys who work together, a third player from that period told me. But we became a team. It felt amazing. Coach was the spark, but it was about more than him. After he came back, it felt like we really believed in each other, like we knew how to play together in a way we didn't before. For the Colts, a belief in their team, in Dungy's tactics, and their ability to win began to emerge out of tragedy. But just as often, a similar belief can emerge without any kind of adversity. In a 1994 Harvard study that examined people who had radically changed their lives, for instance, researchers found that some people had remade their habits after a personal tragedy, such as a divorce or a life-threatening illness. Others changed after they saw a friend go through something awful, the same way that Dungy's players watched him struggle. Just as frequently, however,
There was no tragedy that preceded people's transformations. Rather, they changed because they were embedded in social groups that made change easier. One woman said her entire life shifted when she signed up for a psychology class and met a wonderful group. "It opened a Pandora's box," the woman told researchers. "I could not tolerate the status quo any longer. I had changed in my core." Another man said that he found new friends among whom he could practice being gregarious. "When I do make the effort to overcome my shyness, I feel that it is not really me acting, that it's someone else," he said. But by practicing with his new group, it stopped feeling like acting. He started to believe he wasn't shy, and then, eventually, he wasn't anymore. When people join groups where change seems possible, the potential for that change to occur becomes more real. For most people who overhaul their lives, there are no seminal moments or life-altering disasters. There are simply communities, sometimes of just one other person, who make change believable. One woman told researchers her life transformed after a day spent cleaning toilets, and after weeks of discussing with the rest of the cleaning crew whether she should leave her husband. "Change occurs among other people," one of the psychologists involved in the study, Todd Heatherton, told me. "It seems real when we can see it in other people's eyes." The precise mechanisms of belief are still little understood. No one is certain why a group encountered in a psychology class can convince a woman that everything is different, or why Dungy's team came together after their coach's son passed away. Plenty of people talk to friends about unhappy marriages and never leave their spouses. Lots of teams watch their coaches experience adversity and never gel. But we do know that for habits to permanently change, people must believe that change is feasible. The same process that makes AA so effective, the power of a group to teach individuals how to believe, happens whenever people come together to help one another change. Belief is easier when it occurs within a community. 10 months after Jamie's death, the 2006 football season began. The Colts played peerless football, winning their first 9 games and finishing the year 12-4. They won their first playoff game and then beat the Baltimore Ravens for the divisional title. At that point, they were one step away from the Super Bowl, playing for the conference championship, a game that Dungy had lost 8 times before. The matchup occurred on January 21st, 2007, against the New England Patriots, the same team that had snuffed out the Colts' Super Bowl aspirations twice. The Colts started the game strong, but before the first half ended, they began falling apart. Players were afraid of making mistakes, or so eager to get past the final Super Bowl hurdle that they lost track of where they were supposed to be focusing. They stopped relying on their habits and started thinking too much. Sloppy tackling led to turnovers. One of Peyton Manning's passes was intercepted and returned for a touchdown. Their opponents, the Patriots, pulled ahead 21-3. No team in the history of the NFL had ever overcome so big a deficit in a conference championship. Dungy's team, once again, was going to lose. At halftime, the team filed into the locker room, and Dungy asked everyone to gather around. The noise from the stadium filtered through the closed doors, but inside, everyone was quiet. Dungy looked at his players. "They had to believe," he said. "We faced this same situation, against the same team in 2003, Dungy told them. In that game, they had come within 1 yard of winning. 1 yard. "Get your sword ready, because this time we're going to win."
This is our game. It's our time. The Colts came out in the second half and started playing as they had in every preceding game. They stayed focused on their cues and habits. They carefully executed the plays they had spent the past 5 years practicing until they had become automatic. Their offense, on the opening drive, ground out 76 yards over 14 plays and scored a touchdown. Then, 3 minutes after taking the next possession, they scored again. As the fourth quarter wound down, the teams traded points. The Colts tied the game, but never managed to pull ahead. With 3 minutes 49 seconds left in the game, the Patriots scored, putting Dungy's players at a 3 points disadvantage, 34-31. The Colts got the ball and began driving down the field. They moved 70 yards in 19 seconds and crossed into the end zone. For the first time, the Colts had the lead, 38-34. There were now 60 seconds left on the clock. If Dungy's team could stop the Patriots from scoring a touchdown, the Colts would win. 60 seconds is an eternity in football. The Patriots quarterback, Tom Brady, had scored touchdowns in far less time. Sure enough, within seconds of the start of play, Brady moved his team halfway down the field. With 17 seconds remaining, the Patriots were within striking distance, poised for a final big play that would hand Dungy another defeat and crush, yet again, his team's Super Bowl dreams. As the Patriots approached the line of scrimmage, the Colts' defense went into their stances. Marlon Jackson, a Colts cornerback, stood 10 yards back from the line. He looked at his cues, the width of the gaps between the Patriot linemen and the depth of the running back's stance. Both told him this was going to be a passing play. Tom Brady, the Patriots quarterback, took the snap and dropped back to pass. Jackson was already moving. Brady cocked his arm and heaved the ball. His intended target was a Patriot receiver 22 yards away, wide open, near the middle of the field. If the receiver caught the ball, it was likely he could make it close to the end zone or score a touchdown. The football flew through the air. Jackson, the Colts' cornerback, was already running at an angle, following his habits. He rushed past the receiver's right shoulder, cutting in front of him just as the ball arrived. Jackson plucked the ball out of the air for an interception, ran a few more steps, and then slid to the ground, hugging the ball to his chest. The whole play had taken less than 5 seconds. The game was over. Dungy and the Colts had won. 2 weeks later, they won the Super Bowl. There are dozens of reasons that might explain why the Colts finally became champions that year. Maybe they got lucky. Maybe it was just their time. But Dungy's players say it's because they believed. And because that belief made everything they had learned, all the routines they had practiced until they became automatic, stick, even at the most stressful moments. "We're proud to have won this championship for our leader, Coach Dungy," Peyton Manning told the crowd afterward, cradling the Lombardi trophy. Dungy turned to his wife. "We did it," he said. How do habits change? There is, unfortunately, no specific set of steps guaranteed to work for every person. We know that a habit cannot be eradicated. It must, instead, be replaced. And we know that habits are most malleable when the golden rule of habit change is applied. If we keep the same cue and the same reward, a new routine can be inserted. But that's not enough. For a habit to stay changed, people must believe change is possible. And most often, that belief only emerges with the help of a group. If you want to quit smoking, figure out a different routine that will satisfy the cravings filled by cigarettes. Then, find a support group a collection of other former smokers, or a community that will help you believe you can stay away from nicotine. And use that group when you feel you might stumble. If you want to lose weight, study your habits to determine why you really leave your desk for a snack each day, and then find someone else to take a walk with you to gossip with at their desk rather than in the cafeteria, a group that tracks weight loss goals together, or someone who also wants to keep a stock of apples rather than chips nearby. The evidence is clear. If you want to change a habit, you must find an alternative routine, and your odds of success go up dramatically when you commit to changing as part of a group. Belief is essential, and it grows out of a communal experience, even if that community is only as large as two people. We know that change can happen. Alcoholics can stop drinking. Smokers can quit puffing. Perennial losers can become champions. You can stop biting your nails or snacking at work, yelling at your kids, staying up all night, or worrying over small concerns. And as scientists have discovered, it's not just individual lives that can shift when habits are tended to. It's also companies, organizations, and communities, as the next chapters explain. Part 2. The Habits of Successful Organizations. Chapter 4. Keystone Habits, or the Ballad of Paul O'Neill. Which habits matter most? 1. On a blustery October day in 1987, a herd of prominent Wall Street investors and stock analysts gathered in the ballroom of a posh Manhattan hotel. They were there to meet the new CEO of the Aluminum Company of America, or Alcoa as it was known, a corporation that, for nearly a century, had manufactured everything from the foil that wraps Hershey's Kisses and the metal in Coca-Cola cans to the bolts that hold satellites together. Alcoa's founder had invented the process for smelting aluminum a century earlier, and since then the company had become one of the largest on Earth. Many of the people in the audience had invested millions in Alcoa stock and had enjoyed a steady return. In the past year, however, investor grumblings started. Alcoa's management had made misstep after misstep, unwisely trying to expand into new product lines while competitors stole customers and profits away. So there had been a palpable sense of relief when Alcoa's board announced it was time for new leadership. That relief, though, turned to unease when the choice was announced. The new CEO would be a former government bureaucrat named Paul O'Neill. Many on Wall Street had never heard of him. When Alcoa scheduled this meet-and-greet at the Manhattan Ballroom, every major investor asked for an invitation. A few minutes before noon, O'Neill took the stage. He was 51 years old, trim, and dressed in gray pinstripes and a red power tie. His hair was white and his posture military straight. He bounced up the steps and smiled warmly. He looked dignified, solid, confident, like a chief executive. Then he opened his mouth. "I want to talk to you about worker safety," he said. "Every year, numerous Alcoa workers are injured so badly that they miss a day of work. Our safety record is better than the general American workforce, especially considering that our employees work with metals that are 1,500 degrees and machines that can rip a man's arm off. But it's not good enough. I intend to make Alcoa the safest company in America. I intend to go for zero injuries." The audience was confused. These meetings usually followed a predictable script. A new CEO would start with an introduction, make a faux self-deprecating joke, something about how he slept his way through Harvard Business School. then promised to boost profits and lower costs. Next would come an excoriation of taxes, business regulations, and sometimes, with a fervor that suggested first-hand experience in divorce court, lawyers. Finally, the speech would end with a blizzard of buzzwords: synergy, right-sizing, and co-opetition. At which point everyone could return to their offices, reassured that capitalism was safe for another day. O'Neill hadn't said anything about profits. He didn't mention taxes. There was no talk of using alignment to achieve a win-win synergistic market advantage. For all anyone in the audience knew, given his talk of worker safety, O'Neill might be pro-regulation. It was a terrifying prospect. "Now, before I go any further," O'Neill said, "I want to point out the safety exits in this room." He gestured to the rear of the ballroom. "There's a couple doors in the back, and in the unlikely event of a fire or other emergency, you should calmly walk out, go down the stairs to the lobby, and leave the building." Silence. The only noise was the hum of traffic through the windows. Safety? Fire exits? Was this a joke? One investor in the audience knew that O'Neill had been in Washington, D.C. during the 60s. "Guy must have done a lot of drugs," he thought. Eventually, someone raised a hand and asked about inventories in the aerospace division. Another asked about the company's capital ratios. "I'm not certain you heard me," O'Neill said. "If you want to understand how Alcoa is doing, you need to look at our workplace safety figures. If we bring our injury rates down, it won't be because of cheerleading or the nonsense you sometimes hear from other CEOs. It will be because the individuals at this company have agreed to become part of something important. They've devoted themselves to creating a habit of excellence. Safety will be an indicator that we're making progress in changing our habits across the entire institution. That's how we should be judged." The investors in the room almost stampeded out the doors when the presentation ended. One jogged to the lobby, found a payphone, and called his 20 largest clients. "I said, the board put a crazy hippie in charge, and he's going to kill the company," that investor told me. "I ordered them to sell their stock immediately, before everyone else in the room started calling their clients and telling them the same thing." It was literally the worst piece of advice I gave in my entire career. Within a year of O'Neill's speech, Alcoa's profits would hit a record high. By the time O'Neill retired in 2000, the company's annual net income was 5 times larger than before he arrived, and its market capitalization had risen by $27 billion. Someone who invested $1 million in Alcoa on the day O'Neill was hired would have earned another $1 million in dividends while he headed the company, and the value of their stock would be 5 times bigger when he left. What's more, all that growth occurred while Alcoa became one of the safest companies in the world. Before O'Neill's arrival, almost every Alcoa plant had at least one accident per week. Once his safety plan was implemented, some facilities would go years without a single employee losing a workday due to an accident. The company's worker injury rate fell to 1/20th the U.S. average. So how did O'Neill make one of the largest, stodgiest, and most potentially dangerous companies into a profit machine and a bastion of safety? By attacking one habit, and then watching the changes ripple through the organization. "I knew I had to transform Alcoa," O'Neill told me. "But you can't order people to change. That's not how the brain works. So I decided I was going to start by focusing on one thing. If I could start disrupting the habits around one thing, it would spread throughout the entire company." O'Neill believed that some habits have the power to start a chain reaction, changing other habits as they move through an organization. Some habits, in other words, matter more than others in remaking businesses and lives. These are keystone habits, and they can influence how people work